I'm extremely frustrated, and I'm angry that it's taken so long for us to get to the bottom of these issues.
A report finds rampant problems with the Alaska National Guard's handling of sexual assault cases. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, September 4th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Maryland tax officials investigate whether U.S. Senate candidate Dan Sullivan improperly benefited from resident tax breaks.
We have an obligation, a legal obligation, to investigate every claim that someone is improperly receiving a homestead credit.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by BP Alaska, committed to the state of Alaska through investment, production, and jobs for future generations of Alaskans. More at alaska.bp.com.
An investigation released today details a long list of failures in how the Alaska National Guard handles reports of sexual assault and other matters. In response to the findings, Governor Sean Parnell asked for the resignation of National Guard Major General Thomas Katkus, effective immediately.
This culture of mistrust and failed leadership in the Guard, it ends now.
Governor Parnell requested that the National Guard Bureau Office of Complex Investigations look into allegations in February after receiving complaints about how Guard leadership addressed reports of sexual assault. At a press conference in Anchorage this afternoon, Parnell summarized the findings of the 230-page report.
Alaska Guard members lack trust and confidence in the Alaska National Guard's leadership to handle sexual assault cases or to administer justice for other misconduct in a fair, even-handed manner without reprisal.
The Guard Bureau looked at 37 cases of sexual assault. The Bureau found that many of the cases were reviewed by people who weren't trained to conduct sexual assault investigations. Some victims also told the Guard Bureau they were ostracized and abused by fellow Guard members after reporting sexual assault. Confidentiality was also a problem. One victim of sexual assault reported to the Bureau that she had overheard a fellow service member discussing the details of her own assault while at work. Parnell first heard of issues in the Guard in 2010, and he has been criticized for not acting sooner to correct the problem. Parnell says when he looked into concerns in the past, he heard from Guard members and leadership that the cases were being handled properly. He says the complaints persisted, and that led him to call for this outside investigation.
I'm extremely frustrated, and I'm angry that it's taken so long for us to get to the bottom of these issues. Our Alaska Guard members deserve better. The victims who have been hurt deserve better. And those who have brought complaints forward deserve better. In hindsight, it clearly should not have taken this long.
The report details several other problems in the Alaska Guard, including sexual harassment, discrimination based on race, and fraud committed by Guard members and leadership. The report makes dozens of recommendations for changes and describes a plan to make those changes. Parnell says he will establish a project team to implement the recommendations. Maryland tax authorities said this week they'll investigate whether Republican U.S. Senate candidate Dan Sullivan improperly benefited from tax breaks intended for Maryland residents for a house he owned in the suburbs of Washington, D.C. As APRN's Liz Ruskin reports, Sullivan's voting history in Alaska elections may cost him.
Clearly, Dan Sullivan is an Alaska resident now, and he's legally qualified to run for U.S. Senate. But questions about the length of his residency have dogged him since the start of his campaign. Rival Republican Mead Treadwell said he had mayonnaise with longer tenure in his fridge. And months ago, the Super PAC Put Alaska First zeroed in on a house Sullivan bought in Bethesda, Maryland in 2006 when he worked for the State Department.
Documents show that while Sullivan pocketed a Maryland tax credit for residents living there, he was voting in Alaska, claiming to be one of us.
The head of the Alaska Democratic Party wrote Maryland authorities last week to question whether Sullivan was eligible for that tax break known as the homestead exemption. Party Chair Mike Wenstrup insists the purpose of the letter is fact-finding, not to get Sullivan in trouble with tax collectors.
if he is saying, I am a resident of Maryland to people of Maryland, and also saying, I'm a resident of Alaska to the people of Alaska, you know, he's not being truthful.
Maryland Taxation Department Director Robert Young said this week he hadn't yet received the letter, but he will launch a review of the case.
We have an obligation, a legal obligation, to investigate every claim that someone is improperly receiving a homestead credit.
Maryland legislators passed a law in 2007 to crack down on abuses of the tax break. Young says he gets thousands of complaints a year, many from citizen watchdogs, and some against members of Congress. Just last month, his office told Walt Havenstein, the Republican nominee for governor of New Hampshire, he must pay back $9,000 in homestead credits he got for a condo he owned in Bethesda.
WMUR has learned that Havenstein will be billed for several years of back taxes. This after officials in Maryland have determined that he accepted tax breaks that he shouldn't have.
The Alaska Democratic Party chair says news of the New Hampshire case prompted him to request a review of Sullivan's file. A spokesman for the Sullivan campaign declined a request for an interview for this story. On his campaign website, Sullivan says he never applied for Maryland's homestead credit, which he describes as automatically provided for owner-occupied homes. Young, the Maryland taxman, says it wasn't automatic, but based on a document Sullivan and his wife signed in 2006, swearing the Bethesda house was their principal residence and they planned to live there most of the next year. All told, their Bethesda residency claim saved the Sullivans some $5,000 over the 2.5 years they lived there. Young says he looks to a number of factors in deciding whether a homeowner is eligible for the homestead credit. Physical presence is required, but Young says so is legal presence. And Young says if a person votes in another state, that's evidence he can't overlook.
What's my legal presence? And my legal presence is where I, vote.
According to the state's voter list, Sullivan voted by mail in Alaska's general election in 2008, during the period he was claiming Maryland's homestead credit. Sullivan's campaign website says he and his wife considered their time outside Alaska as a temporary duty assignment. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
A federal appeals court has overturned a lower court decision in a Clean Water Act case. According to attorneys for the Sierra Club, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, meeting in Anchorage in August, has ruled that Aurora Energy Services and the Alaska Railroad Corporation are in violation of the act by dumping coal from their Seward coal export facility into Resurrection Bay. Yesterday's ruling reverses an earlier court decision in which the lower federal district court said the facility's storm water permit protected Aurora and the railroad from liability for the pollution. This latest decision finds that the terms of the permit prohibit dumping coal in the bay. The Ninth Circuit has sent the case back to federal district court. Vicki Clark, an attorney with Trustees for Alaska, represented the plaintiffs, Alaska Community Action on Toxics, and the Sierra Club.
The court was clear that just the plain terms of the permit, the stormwater permit that they have, do not cover them. And so they can't be shielded from having to get a proper permit under the Clean Water Act for these discharges.
Tim Sullivan with the Alaska Railroad External Affairs responded in an email yesterday that the railroad is reviewing the ruling. Despite the ruling, ARRC and AES have not been found liable for any violations of the Clean Water Act. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the YWCA works to ensure women make wages on par with men.
If we continue to do nothing at this rate, women and men will make equal pay in the year 2142, which is really not acceptable.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's business dreams grow for more than 90 years. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. And by Nana Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine.
At the site of an ancient village near Quinnahock, Archaeologists race against erosion to uncover Yupik artifacts. What they find not only provides a look into the daily lives of Yupik ancestors, but also sheds light on a brutal period in the region's history. KYUK's Charles Enoch visited the site and has this story.
A cold breeze from the Bering Sea sweeps clouds across a tundra hill upon which sits the ancient village of Aghalik. Students and archaeologists are carefully scraping away layers of soil when something catches the attention of the crew.
Hey, Rick. Real pretty.
The abandoned village of Aghalik is about 5 miles south of Gwynhaq, home of Warren Jones, president of Qanikhtuk Incorporated, the tribal corporation. There was a sense of urgency in 2009, Jones explains, when people first noticed erosion along the shoreline was exposing artifacts. Afraid that the site and its treasures would be lost for good, Jones contacted the University of Aberdeen in Scotland. 5 years later, he says the artifacts are bringing elders' stories to life.
It's like the elders are saying in their own way, "We told you so." Now, all the little stories are coming alive.
Today, there's a show and tell of some of the items excavated from the site at a community building. Gwynhaq elder John Atasuk Fox says this about a miniature carving of a human-like face.
That was made by a shaman. It's not that way for no reason.
Other elders agree that it might be the case. On display are many variations of household items, tools, and jewelry. One item that stands out is a labret, a piece of carved wood or stone that Yupik people once wore by inserting them into piercings. Men wore two, one along each jawbone, while women wore one over their chin. Other discoveries point to a violent end for the village. Weapons were also found at the site, along with a layer of ash and skeletal remains of humans who seem to have died in an attack. Rick Connect is the lead archaeologist on the project. He says the site holds evidence of the warring period known in Yupik folklore as the Bow and Arrow Wars.
There is a piece of armor, you know, that's derived from Asian samurai armor, where there's these overlapping plates, except it's made of antlers, sewn together. And here's some more evidence of the Bow and Arrow Wars. This is one of the burned arrow points that we found in the ruins of the house that was fired at somebody in anger. Roof sods and stuff, absolutely riddled with those kind of points. 75% of all the arrow points in the house were found in that upper layer.
Archaeologists say that it's the first tangible evidence of the Bow and Arrow Wars, or Anguyech Pashchatni, as the period is called in Yupik. Stories say that Aghalik residents were massacred in a ferocious attack by the old village of Qinaq, and the village was burned and renamed Aghalik, which means lots of ash, due to the amount of ash or araq in Yupik, which was present on the site after the attack. While it's clear that Aghalik residents experienced war, archaeologists also discovered signs of everyday life. Anne Riordan was there on behalf of the Chalista Elders Council. One of the biggest things that struck her was how similar, yet different, some of the artifacts are to modern tools and crafts used by Yupik people today.
There was an ulok with a little indentation in it, but if you hold it, your thumb just fits in it beautifully. I've never seen one like it, and it's made out of stone and wood.
With climate change causing erosion across much of the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta, Riordan says other communities could carry out similar projects, but the clock is ticking.
There's just never been anything this big in our area. And there's lots and lots of old sites, many other old sites that are being washed away. Many more communities could have this experience.
Back at the dig site, University of Oregon graduate student Anna Sloan uncovers what instantly has everyone at the site smitten.
That is so cool. God.
Yeah,
and
pretty
what
sweet,
this,
right?
Huh?
Yeah.
It's an ulok, a woman's cutting knife with an ivory handle, beautifully carved in the likeness of a mythical sea monster known as the Balrayak. It will travel to Scotland for study and preservation before being returned. Tribal leaders say they will eventually display it either in Bethel or in Gwynhaq for future generations. In Bethel, I'm Charles Enoch.
Women in Alaska earn significantly less than men, and the YWCA is setting out to change that. Their new initiative aims to close the wage gap by 2025. One of the solutions may be simple: encourage more women to join the trades. KSKA's Ann Hillman reports.
Deborah Kelly walks through the maze of buildings at MLNP in Anchorage, where she works.
So this is the line shop, the barn. Got all of our bucket trucks, and we got some tree trimmers at work here as well.
Kelly is a lineman, which means she fixes high-voltage power and telephone lines.
This is what we actually use to climb the poles.
The slight young woman pulls out a contraption that looks like an ancient leg brace attached to leather chaps.
And there's a small spike that is angled out from that actually goes into the wood. You just walk up the pole like you're walking on the ground. Only different.
Seriously?
Yes, it's great.
Kelly says she didn't plan on working on power and phone lines, but when she tried it out during her apprenticeship with the IBW, she instantly fell in love. There was just one problem. She's a woman.
Well, I definitely had to prove to everybody why I was there and that I deserved to be in the trade, because most guys have never worked with a woman, and a lot of them have never even heard of a woman in the trade. I'm only the second one in the history of Alaska.
The line trade is not the only industry where women are grossly underrepresented. State Department of Labor data shows few women work in natural resource development and construction as well, some of the highest paying jobs in the state. And the state economists say that contributes to the overall gender pay gap. State estimates show that a woman makes only 67 cents for every dollar a man makes. YWCA of Alaska CEO Hillary Morgan says the gap is closing too slowly, only 5 cents in 20 years.
If we continue to do nothing at this rate, women and men will make equal pay in the year 2142, which is really not acceptable.
Her organization is trying to close it by 2025 instead. How? Morgan says she's not exactly sure.
When Kennedy said he was going to the moon, he didn't know how he was going to get there either, but he was going to get there.
Morgan says the first step is changing societal norms. People need to stop accepting the pay gap as normal. She says the YWCA is partnering with other organizations and industries in Alaska to try to educate people on the discrepancy and to develop solutions. She says they're also creating a tool to help businesses and organizations measure if they treat women differently.
Many of them, their intent is not to pay their female employees less than their male employees. I think that that just happens over time, and because nobody's really looking at the issue.
Back at MLNP, Kelly walks through the halls, joking with some of her colleagues.
And don't talk to this guy.
Trouble.
Yeah.
Kelly says she had to fight to get the same training as the men during her apprenticeship because her crew doubted her abilities and wanted to protect her because she's so small. She says she confronted sheer pigheadedness, too. The men didn't understand what she was doing there. Kelly says the challenges were worth it.
It's the best job in the world, and skepticism and a few bad apples are not worth giving that up over.
Kelly says she hopes to see other women doing what she does, and the sooner the better. In Anchorage, I'm Ann Hillman.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Crowley, celebrating 60 years in Alaska. Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. And by ExxonMobil Alaska, where more than 1,000 Alaskan men and women are working on the Point Thompson Project, proving energy lives here.
A California energy company is exploring establishing a liquefied natural gas plant at Port McKenzie to supply gas to interior Alaska and the rail belt. Westpac representatives outlined the plan to the Matanuska-Susitna Borough Assembly last week. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports.
Westpac, with offices in Fresno and Oakland, California, and in Reno, Nevada, plans to spend about $600 million on LNG infrastructure at Port McKenzie, according to company Vice President Brad Barnes, who made the pitch to the Borough Assembly in late August.
Our objectives in Alaska are to build, own, and operate new scalable midstream LNG facilities in the Cook Inlet, to establish an LNG alternative for Fairbanks and the interior markets, to create new markets for natural gas in rural and coastal Alaska by displacing high-cost diesel. We believe that we also, by putting in a new facility at Port McKenzie, we'll be in a position to offer peaking gas to the greater Rail Belt communities by putting gas on demand into the pipeline system to meet peak day requirements.
He said Westpac became interested in Cook Inlet gas some years ago when it seemed like the inlet's natural gas supplies were running low. Since a resurgence of natural gas development in the inlet, Westpac wants to jump on board the rush to get cheap fuel to Alaska's interior villages.
The integration would be the proven reserves plus the LNG facility plus the rail and the marine infrastructure necessary to move LNG by rail car or truck or vessel to rural Alaska. The site that we're intending is 100 acres at Port McKenzie. The facility itself would be on par with the current facility and contemplated for the North Slope to Fairbanks on the order of 250,000 gallons of LNG per day. We'd connect to the existing NSTAR pipeline, which is approximately 15 miles away.
Barnes said Westpac is working with the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority and with the Department of Natural Resources on the proposed project, although he said it would be privately financed. He said the project could provide 350 jobs during the construction phase and about 30 permanent ones. Westpac is in the process of information gathering and will be ready to make a firm proposal in about 3 months, he said. Karsten Rodvik, spokesman for ADA, says Westpac representatives have met with the state corporation, although there is no firm plan on the table yet.
Well, we're certainly aware of the Westpac idea, and I'm not aware yet of any formal business proposal that has come to us. If one does come through the door, it will, of course, go through the same kind of rigorous due diligence process that any proposed or potential project goes through when we look at it.
ADA is a billion-dollar public corporation of the state, which is self-funded and does not depend on legislative appropriations. It returns an annual dividend to the state, which goes into the state's general fund. Westpac specializes in gas storage, pipelines, and fuel depots. The company operates facilities on the East Coast and is working with Tote Ocean Marine on designing an LNG bunkering operation in the United States using container vessels to deliver LNG from Florida to Puerto Rico. Barnes said his company is working with 5 Cook Inlet gas producers who are interested in the Port McKenzie project, but he declined to name those companies. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Seismologists are ramping up efforts to monitor the region where a major interior earthquake occurred. SKUAC's Dan Bross reports the area was already targeted for research.
The magnitude 5 earthquake was centered in the Minto Flats west of Fairbanks. Geologic timing is fickle, and state seismologist Michael West regrets how it worked out, given a research project slated to get underway in the flats.
The earthquake on Saturday evening was a little bit bittersweet for us.
The National Science Foundation-funded project led by University of Alaska Fairbanks Geophysical Institute professor Carl Tape was immediately accelerated, and newly developed underground monitoring instrumentation is being deployed this week. West says they hope to capture high-resolution data on aftershocks.
An earthquake like Saturday night is recorded all across Alaska and really recorded pretty well across North America. But the closer you are to the source, the more fidelity you have in recording, you know, the more subtle ground motions.
West expects aftershocks to continue for a few weeks.
When you have an earthquake that's as large as magnitude 5, there are hundreds of small aftershocks. And by studying the aftershocks, we actually learn a lot about the earthquake itself in mapping out the fault and explaining the stresses that led to the earthquake in the first place.
The Minto Flats is historically known to produce earthquakes, but the wet tundra-covered region offers little surface clues to what's going on 10 miles underground.
Underneath Minto Flats is a large basin that is, it's like a bathtub that's been filled with dirt. And the reason that that's there is because the Earth has pulled apart in some sense and opened up what we refer to as a basin. And the earthquakes are associated with that basin.
West says the region's deep earthquakes are not felt as strongly as those closer to the surface in other areas, but notes residents of the village of Minto, just 10 miles from the epicenter of the recent big quake, won't soon forget it.
Certainly lots of reports from people who did not sleep well on Saturday night because of the recurring aftershocks. A lot of things falling off of shelves and breaking.
The earthquake was felt less intensely around the rest of the interior, and West says no reports of damage have been received. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
The Lower Kuskokwim School District is moving forward on a school-based health center for students in Bethel. KYUK's Ben Matheson has more.
Jacob Jensen, the superintendent for the Lower Kuskokwim School District, says the idea is to offer services provided from the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation and the state's public health nursing program at a Bethel school.
That could be anything from sports physicals to talking about reproductive health to sexually transmitted diseases to the common cold, you know, all of those different things. While it doesn't have a direct impact on, you know, what we do as far as educating the kids, if you're sick, you know, if you've got a sore throat or you're ill, you're not going to be able to come to school. So if you can get that taken care of while you're at school, we thought that would be a benefit for the community.
The agreements are not yet in place, but Jensen is hopeful it could be open by the end of October. They plan to have it open just one day a month at the start, and the location is not yet finalized at the high school or district office. Regardless of the exact placement, Dr. Joe Klaika, the corporate medical director for YKHC, says locating it near the students is crucial.
It's an important time in your life where frequently students don't really get a lot of medical care because they don't seek it out. And this makes it more convenient. There's a lot of questions they may have, different issues that are unique to students that makes it very available to them.
Klaika says it may be staffed by a pediatric resident through YKHC. Other providers from the public health nursing office could offer services like sexually transmitted infection testing and treatment, plus pregnancy testing and information on birth control. Public health nurse Katie Krings says that is done on a confidential basis.
So they can receive these services. Their parents aren't notified. It's a state law. So they would be able to receive those services at our health clinic here in town, same as they would be at the school-based health center if that gets started.
The YKHC board has not yet acted on the proposal. Jensen says he believes this will be the first student health center of its kind in rural Alaska. In Bethel, I'm Ben Matheson.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer and Ann Hillman in Anchorage, Charles Enoch in Quinnahawk, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Ben Matheson in Bethel. APRN's Liz Ruskin reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by Craig Taylor Equipment Company, an authorized dealer for over 15 manufacturers, including John Deere and Bobcat, celebrating 60 years of business in Alaska. More at CraigTaylorEquipment.com. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.